Do you like the idea of studying and observing space and the stars? I spoke to astronomer Seth Shostak, a very interesting interview about his career and his most recent work at SETI, the institute that is looking for proof of intelligent beings in other star systems. Enjoy the episode. Thank you, Seth, to be at my podcast. I'm very happy to welcome an astronomer. I would like to ask, what is your background, academic background?
I studied physics as an undergraduate, and then I went to grad school, and I entered in the physics department, but I very quickly switched to astronomy because that seemed a little bit more romantic to me.
Romantic, okay. What did you want to do that was more romantic than other sciences?
Well, I'm not sure there was anything specific. I don't know. It just seemed to me that using big telescopes and like that, you know, it was just more appealing than joining a group of 100 other physicists and doing some experiment on a big machine that you couldn't actually get to yourself. In astronomy, certainly at that time, as a lone person working on a project, you could actually do something useful. Physics hasn't been like that for a while. Physics is done now by teams of physicists. And, you know, that didn't sound as much fun to me.
How long did it take you then to become an astronomer?
Well, I went through about 5 or 6 years of grad school, and I didn't really want to leave grad school because it was a lot of fun in the end. But after that, I took a postdoc position in a radio observatory, so I was doing astronomy there, and eventually worked in Europe at a university in the astronomy department there, and then came to California, not to do astronomy, actually, but when I got here, the SETI Institute, which happens to be in the city in which I live, Mountain View, called me up, and they said, you want a job here? So I took it.
Okay, and what did you do? What was your job there at the SETI Institute?
Well, my job at the SETI Institute, my title is Senior Astronomer, but that may just be a reflection of my age more than anything else. But what we were doing and are doing is trying to find life in space. And SETI is, you know, just an acronym for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And so that's the project in which I've been involved. I do a lot of other things at the SETI Institute, do a lot of writing and stuff like that. But, you know, the science is trying to find ET.
Going back to your studies, can you tell me, like, names a few subjects that you have studied during your astronomy studies?
Well, as I say, as an undergraduate, I was studying physics, which is always good because astronomy is, these days, largely physics. Mm-hmm. So you need a background in physics in order to become an astronomer, really. You should have that. But, you know, there was the usual curriculum for a physics major, which meant that you take, you know, freshman physics, which is mechanics and electricity and magnetism, then you take more specialized courses in those subjects, and eventually you take quantum mechanics and modern physics. So, you know, it was the sort of the basis of a physics education. When I was in grad school, taking courses also in astronomy, then they would be sort of the basis courses in astronomy, you know, radiative transfer or the dynamics of star systems, stuff like that. So, you know, all you have to do is look at the curriculum at any school that has programs in either astronomy or physics or both, and you can see what the courses are. There isn't a whole lot of choice in these. I mean, there isn't that you're going to have a whole bunch of electives because the school can't offer so many astronomy courses that you can just take, I'll just take these three out of the total of 30 that are being offered. There might be 5 being offered and you take them all.
Okay. Do you find that young people today would be interested in studying astronomy and becoming astronomers today?
Oh, yes, very much so. The National Science Foundation in this country actually did a survey a number of years ago, although I doubt that the results would be any different today. And they found that the two most popular science courses for students, at least in the United States, were biology and astronomy. Astronomy, it isn't terribly useful, at least not directly, but it has a certain appeal. I mean, anybody who has looked at the night sky, you know, and kind of wondered, well, what is all that stuff and, you know, where'd it come from and where's it going? And astronomy addresses those questions. It addresses where, you know, why there's something out there and how did it produce us? These sorts of questions, they're very fundamental questions. They won't help you necessarily, you know, get along with your relatives, but it is good in the sense of giving you sort of a philosophical basis, actually, for why we're here.
I have interviewed in the past an astronaut. What is the difference between an astronaut and an astronomer?
Well, an astronaut is somebody who goes into space, after all, but they don't necessarily have any knowledge of astronomy. I mean, all the American astronauts up through the Apollo program, which is to say up through the landings on the moon and so forth, these were basically military pilots. They were pilots. They could fly, you know, jet aircraft and so forth. But I've had dinners with a couple of these guys, and, you know, they're quite interesting people, but they don't know any astronomy. And I mean, they would ask me questions about the moon, even though they had walked on the moon, right? But they don't know anything about the science of the sky, of astronomy. So that's the difference. An astronaut is, I mean, it's like saying, you know, what's the difference between a marine biologist and the captain of the, you know, of a ship?
So there are like no common subjects that you guys study in terms of astronomy?
Well, I'm not sure I would say no, but in general not, no.
In general, okay. No, I was thinking because I imagine that one is, of course, more hands-on, let's say, having the experience of actually going to space, and then the other one stays theoretical. Does astronomy really stay theoretical?
No. Most astronomers are observational. In fact, astronomy is, you know, strictly speaking, an observational subject. There are theoreticians, it's true, but they're basically physicists. But astronomy, because of its history, has always been an observational science. What's interesting is what you can see through a telescope, right? And if you can't see it through a telescope, if you just had this idea and you write it down on paper, that isn't going to get too many people's attention unless you can find it in the sky too. So just having an idea, it's not like, quite like physics where you can make theoretical predictions. With astronomy, almost all discoveries, not all, but almost all discoveries come from observations. People point a telescope at the sky and they suddenly see something they hadn't seen before that they don't understand. And then the theoreticians can get busy trying to figure out what it might be. Mm-hmm. But it is an observational science. And that's one of the appeals of astronomy, right? The telescope rules.
That's true. Before the SETI Institute, what was your career into astronomy? Was it the first job that you did or not?
No, I've had lots and lots of jobs. I mean, I've worked for all sorts of, in all sorts of endeavors, not just astronomy. I founded a computer animation company in Europe, and you know, we made leaders and logos for spinning logos for television. I worked for the railroads here in the United States. I worked for a software startup company, so I've had lots of jobs. But astronomy is what I was schooled in, at least in grad school. So I've really always come back to that. I'm not sure why sometimes, but that it has an endless appeal because astronomy is always changing. It's always different. There's always something new. Every week there's something new.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it must be amazing. It's interesting that you have had many different jobs because I, in my head, of course, not knowing anything about astronomy or the career of an astronomer, I would imagine that you get out of school, university, you graduate, and then you get into that line of work immediately and you gain experience and you become an expert and senior astronomer. But it's really interesting to see that the path can be actually quite different and you still get to be an astronomer at the SETI Institute, for instance, or any other for that matter.
It's true. But, you know, the number of jobs in astronomy as a discipline are relatively few. Right, it isn't. There are many more jobs, for example, in physics, or if you study information technology, right, IT. There are many, many more jobs there than there are in astronomy. So astronomy can be a little bit selective. At least when they hire somebody to be an astronomer, to really be an astronomer, then you know, almost everybody has to get a PhD. If you don't get that, you're probably not going to get a job as an astronomer. You can get a job in astronomy, but it might be teaching at some organization or some institution. It might be, you know, running a planetarium or something like that. But if your goal is to do you know, fundamental astronomy research, then you kind of need a PhD, which is a bit of a shame, but that's the situation.
Is that true in Europe and the US and the rest of the world?
Yes. Or,
yeah.
Yes.
I guess also
true throughout the world.
The competition has got stronger. Maybe also 50 or 60 years ago, it was less the case.
Yes, I think that's fair to say. 50, 60 years, there was less competition. But, you know, and if you go back 200 years or something like that.
There was no competition.
Well, there was competition, but you didn't have to be specially trained in astronomy, because if you had access to a university library, you could learn everything that was known in astronomy, you know, on the weekend. It didn't take very long, but that's not true anymore.
So are there any prerequisites in terms of, soft skills that you would say are relevant for this career?
Well, none come to mind right away. I mean, obviously, if you have some expertise in electronics or, coding, writing computer code and so forth, that would help you. As far as soft skills about getting along with people, well, if you don't get along with people, Edwin Hubble wasn't so good as a people person, but he was a very famous astronomer. You know, you have to get along with your colleagues at some level. It's not that there's more demanded of you in that regard than there would be in any other job in academia, I don't think. Soft skills, yeah, fine, that people like you, that can only help, but that's not going to get you your job.
Mm-hmm. And when you do observation, at the SETI Institute, is that what you do? Like, do you actually observe?
Well, it's all automated these days, so I have observed, but that's mostly a matter of sending some files, computer files, to the telescope. The telescope is about 500 kilometers north of San Francisco, and to go up there, you know, it takes a while to get up there. It's much faster just to send an email with the coordinates that you want to observe and stuff like that. But in the old days, you would go to the telescope, but that hasn't been true for a very long time now.
Oh, that's too bad, because that was the romantic part that I was expecting you to tell me.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure it was so romantic. I mean, in the very old days, you're going to an optical telescope that's on top of a mountain. It's probably freezing cold.
Freezing cold.
You can't heat the dome. You just have to sit there all night, guiding the telescope. Not necessarily fun.
I was at Mauna Kea once, and it was at the observatory. It was freezing cold. It was 30 degrees Celsius down below, and it was zero up. But it did look very, very appealing, and there were astronomers inside. So you say the observation today is completely automatized?
Most telescopes, I mean, people who use the telescopes in Hawaii tell me that they do their observing from their bedrooms here in California. They don't go to Hawaii anymore.
Even that is out of the question now.
Well, I mean, it's not necessary, and it doesn't necessarily help to go there.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like it's more fun, and it might be, but, you don't always do it because you're interested in the data.
Yeah, okay. It doesn't really make any difference anymore to be
in
close,
general,
physically
in general,
close.
Not, no.
Okay. Not even like to exchange with colleagues, or everything is done.
No, they're not going to the telescope either.
Yeah. So what does an observation consist of?
Well, an observation means you're pointing the telescope. I mean, it depends on what kind of telescope you're talking about. There are all kinds. There's traditional optical telescopes with mirrors and so forth, like the ones you find on Mauna Kea or whatever in Hawaii.
Yeah.
There are radio telescopes. Those are the kinds that I've used most of my life that are just look like giant antennas or farms of antennas, lots of them scattered around. There are space telescopes like the James Webb Space Telescope that's just now producing some interesting pictures, or the Hubble Space Telescope. So, there are various kinds of telescopes, but all of them basically you would use the same way. In other words, you would send it a list of the objects you want to observe and, information about the equipment that you want on the telescope and how long they look at each object and that sort of thing. You send essentially a file to the telescope, and the locals there deal with it by, doing the observing for you, or in many cases it's almost completely automated. So that's the way it's done. And as I say, it's not necessarily romantic per se, but on the other hand, the interest is in what you learn. And So sitting on top of the mountain all night is maybe or maybe not so interesting.
So when I am a young person wanting to become an astronomer, what are my options career-wise? What can I do?
Well, there are various kinds of careers you could have. Obviously, you could, if you want to do research, for example, you could try and get a job at a university, right, a tenure track position or something. And maybe if you get tenure, then, you know, of course, you have to keep teaching. But on the other hand, you get to do your own research in many universities, most universities. So that's kind of the standard career path. Mm-hmm. But if you don't want to do that, you could teach at astronomy, actually, at community colleges. You could work at a planetarium and present shows to the public. You could write books about astronomy or magazine articles. You could work for Astronomy Magazine. You know, there's some people who actually make a living by giving talks. I give a lot of talks, actually, but I don't make a living out of doing that. I don't earn that much. But, you know, there are people who do that or just write books about it.
Is there any link to other industries, commercially speaking? You know, when I spoke to a mathematician and he opened my mind to all the kind of possibilities that a mathematician has in terms of implementation in other industries and fields of work. Is there something that can be applied also in astronomy?
The astronomy per se is probably not applicable to too many industries, but, you know, the skills that you learn doing astronomy research, which, you know, include programming computers and stuff like that, that's obviously applicable in lots of different fields. And just perhaps the mental discipline that, you know, you have to be logical, you have to consider what the data are saying, not what you want the data to say, and that sort of thing. Those are skills that, you know, are useful in a wide variety of contexts. The other thing is having to write up your results in a coherent way. I tell students frequently that the most important skill they learn in school is how to write, because that's useful for almost any job you take.
Any job, yeah, you're completely right. That's true. Is there something you particularly enjoy about your profession?
I enjoy my job because it's highly varied. I'm not doing the same thing every day. Every day is completely different, right? Except for the fact that I have to answer email. But I mean, it really is always changing, and there's always something new. And in the field of SETI, where I'm working now, you know, there's actually something new, even though we haven't found ET despite having looked for a long time. But there's always something new in terms of the astronomy. We learn that, you know, this star over here has some planets that look intriguing in terms of their possible sites as places where there's life, you know, that kind of thing. But there's also the fact that you can build better equipment all the time because computers keep getting faster. There's always something new. That, to me, is a good thing. I mean, I think that I would go stir crazy if my job were the same from day to day.
I hear you. And is there something particularly difficult you find in your job, your line of work?
It's highly specialized, obviously. I mean, as I say, I work in SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and I think the public believes that there are many, many people working in this field because, you know, it's covered a lot in TV shows, occasionally movies. But in fact, the total number of people in the world that are doing this is maybe 30, maybe 20, somewhere around there. It's a very, very specialized sort of thing.
I thought it would be more investment into that, but maybe there's more into other explorations like going to Mars.
Well, I think the problem with SETI is that you cannot guarantee a success. You cannot go to the government or to a, you know, just to a rich guy and say, "Hey, look, Bob, you know, give me this amount of money and we'll find ET." Right?
Yeah.
And he can give you that amount of money, but you might or might not find ET. So it's a bit of a gamble. It's like what the Europeans did. They spent $5,000 million building the Large Hadron Collider on the border of France and Switzerland. And, you know, they thought they could find the Higgs boson. And as it turns out, they did find the Higgs boson, this elusive particle. Was it worth $5 billion? Probably in the end, it is worth that. But in any case, you know, they felt pretty certain that they would learn something about the Higgs boson. They could promise that. It's $5 billion, but this is what you're going to get out of it, minimum. But in the case of my area of astronomy, you can't make that claim. You can't say $5 billion will find ET for you.
Yeah, that's interesting. So we're not close to finding...
Well, I don't know what close means. You know, it's kind of a one-bit experiment. Either you found them or you haven't. So how can you be close, right? It's, you know, it's sort of like pregnancy, right? I mean, either you are or you're not. How can you be close? I don't know.
Do you have a fun anecdote about your years in your astronomy career as an astronomer?
I think that for the anecdotes to really come out, it had to be having a coffee somewhere and we're talking about something else. And that will remind me of something, you know, bizarre that has happened to me. But many bizarre things have happened. So I'm sure that, I'm sure the conversation would take an anecdotal turn.
Is there any lesson you've learned in the past that others can benefit from, or things that you would also do otherwise now that you have several years behind you?
I have to say, when I was young and, you know, these old guys would come in and give you advice and, you know, listen, son, this is what I'm trying to tell you here. This is, you pay attention because I've been around a long time and I think you ought to listen. I never listened to those guys. I never listened to them. You know, so it's sort of like the scene, famous scene in the movie, The Graduate, where a guy tells Dustin Hoffman, plastics, right? It's a magic word, plastics. Okay, well, I don't have anything like that. I do, however, occasionally volunteer to young people that they should do something that they really like, that they get excited about, that they wake up in the morning and they want to, you know, do something in that area. Because if not, you know, you might be making more money, but that's not going to make you as happy as doing something that you really enjoy. You should enjoy your job. Not everybody can enjoy their job. Very few people, in fact, can enjoy their job. But if you're going to go into something that's of academic bent, then I would say make sure it's something you really like and you're not doing it just because your mom said you should.
That's a good advice. Of course, there's always the balance between between learning something that can lead you to a job and then learning something that might not lead to a job. And then we all need to earn money, earn a living in life. This is always the struggle, right? It's like when you say, I want to be an actor or I want to be an astronaut. Not many can become astronauts.
That's true. But I have to say that in that area, in this realm, Europe and the United States actually differ because Europe would ask people to be more practical. But America, you know, it has its own mythology. And if you want to be an astronaut, okay, fine. You know, you might or might not actually become an astronaut, but they wouldn't discourage you from trying simply because there aren't many jobs in that field. And that was different for me, at least when I lived in Europe, that they tried to be practical and say, look, you should go into a field where you know you're going to be able to get a job. That attitude doesn't really, it's far less of an issue in the United States. It's also, I mean, there are really are cultural differences. SETI, what I do, is not done in Europe anymore. It isn't done at all. And it isn't that Europe doesn't have the money. They have the money. It's not that they don't have the equipment. They do. It's not that they don't have the, you know, the people who know what they need to know. They do. But they still don't do it. And they don't do it, I think, for cultural reasons. It doesn't have anything to do with their ability to do it.
They don't see the point in it, or it's not practical enough?
Yeah, I think it's not practical enough. That's what I was told in Holland, but, you know, I think it's true in many countries. And it does surprise me because the Europeans have the ability to do this kind of an experiment, and they, so far, haven't shown much interest. That may change. The Chinese are getting interested, so there's that.
I was going to say, I wonder what happens in Asia. What is the approach in Asia?
Asia hasn't really had the equipment to do very much in this field, but that's changing. The Chinese have built the world's largest single-dish radio telescope, the so-called FAST telescope. It's 500 meters across. It's a big thing. And one thing they want to use it for is SETI, to try and see if they can eavesdrop on ET. So they say they're going to do it.
I will look for a Chinese astronomer to interview next time and see what he thinks. I hope that we can have another conversation and then you'll tell me about your anecdotes in front of a cup
of
coffee.
All right. I'll try and write them down. It's like I don't remember jokes. You know, I don't remember them, but I make them all the time.
Yeah, I know. when you need them, they don't come. But it's been great. Thank you. Thank you for accepting.
Thank you for having me.
Very entertaining, Seth Shostak. Now that you know what an astronomer does, you can compare it with episode 19, where I spoke with the German astronaut, Thomas Reiter, so you'll see what's the difference between an astronaut and an astronomer. For more job tales, stay tuned. Thank you.